Welcome back to another episode of Edgewood College's Astronomy Podcast. I'm Melissa, student member of the Astronomy Outreach Program at Edgewood College, located in Madison, Wisconsin. With me today, we have returning guest David Cordy, Assistant Professor of Geoscience at Edgewood College. And I'm excited to bring him back because we have another interesting topic to discuss. An asteroid that was a large factor in the mass extinction event. David, thanks for coming on our podcast again. How are you?
I'm doing very well. Thanks for having me back, Melissa.
We will introduce a topic that will demonstrate the relationships between geology, biology, paleontology, and astronomy. The event related to the extinction of the dinosaurs. There was a crater found off of the Yucatan Peninsula, which was the result of one of the most well-known mass extinction events that removed 75% of plant and animal species. How big was this asteroid, and why was this asteroid so impactful?
So undoubtedly a lot of people have heard of this particular event. Giant space rocks are always very exciting for people to learn about. So the crater that you mentioned off the coast of the Yucatan Peninsula is about 100 miles wide, a little bit less than that. So clearly a very large event. The impactor, the thing that actually caused the crater, was probably about 7 to 8 miles wide. So definitely a very large hunk of material coming in from space. And when it hit the Earth, it obviously had a really large impact. And it just kind of happened to hit in an area that made it extremely devastating to a lot of organisms. That part of the world just off the Yucatan Peninsula has a lot of rocks that contain sulfate. And sulfate, when it's hit, it can actually get sent into the atmosphere and cause a lot of drastic changes to the environment.
The dinosaurs had a long reign. The Cretaceous period lasted around 79 million years. Hell Creek Formation is one of the more well-known areas to study, one of the final resting areas for dinosaurs that died around the time of the asteroid impact. There and around the world lies this dark line in the strata of the rocks known as the KPG boundary, which is believed to solve this 3-meter problem. How was this boundary confirmed that it was created from an asteroid impact, and how did it immediately help locate the crater?
Yeah, a lot of good information you just mentioned. So dinosaurs existed in the Cretaceous period. Geologists break up the timeline based on different geologic periods, and the Cretaceous is one of those periods that had a lot of dinosaurs, and it was the final period. And the Hell Creek Formation is a group of rocks where dinosaurs are frequently found, especially in North America. So a lot of the dinosaurs that people see in museums actually come from the Hell Creek Formation. However, even though the Hell Creek Formation is one of the best known and most prolific sources of dinosaur fossils, our discovery of dinosaur extinction actually comes from the other side of the world, in Italy. So scientists knew for a long time that the Cretaceous was the last interval in which dinosaurs existed. Like, it didn't take a lot of guesswork to see, okay, dinosaurs in one unit, and then in the unit above that, there were no more dinosaurs. So we knew there was an extinction. We just didn't really know what happened to these organisms. And in like the 50s and 60s and 70s, a lot of guesses were put out there about what caused the extinction, many of which didn't have a lot of evidence to support them, so they weren't really accepted even at the time. Until in the 1980s, there was actually a big breakthrough in our understanding of this event. There are two scientists, Walter and Louis Alvarez, father-son pairing of geologists. Louis Alvarez was the senior who was actually a Nobel Prize winning physicist, and Walter Alvarez was a geologist. And they were doing a study in Italy, and they were actually studying something completely different from what we're talking about here today. They're actually studying about the effects of plate tectonics. And in the process of studying this, they noticed that they were working at the very end of the Cretaceous. And just at the top of the Cretaceous, the rocks that were deposited in the Cretaceous, I should say, they noticed like a dark line of material. And when they sampled that material, more so out of curiosity and trying to answer some other questions, they noticed that that layer of rock that divided up the Cretaceous and the Paleogene was extremely rich in a really rare element. It had a lot of an element known as iridium. Iridium is pretty uncommon. You're highly unlikely to find any iridium in your daily life. However, it is really common in asteroids. So Walter and Luis Alvarez made the assumption that, well, if iridium is really rare on Earth, yet it's found in a lot in this one particular layer, this must be deposits from an asteroid. So that was the first time that we really had strong evidence that an asteroid could have occurred, and it happened to occur, be deposited right at the time in which we see a switch from dinosaur-bearing layers of rock to not to areas that don't have a lot of dinosaurs in them. So eventually, we did find other information, like the crater, as you mentioned before, that really helped us support that initial hypothesis.
Yeah, and so when the asteroid hit Earth, it was quite disastrous. It struck with speeds of around 40,000 miles per hour. So, what were the events that occurred right after that impact? I know of an example would be tsunami deposits that were found in areas like Texas or Florida. Can you elaborate more on other impacts we would have seen at a local level and on a global scale?
Yeah, absolutely. It's pretty reasonable that with an event like this, you can get those massive tsunamis that we have evidence for in Texas, as you say. So a lot of people, when they picture an asteroid hitting the Earth, they just kind of picture a rock and it lands on the Earth, and the area in which that rock lands, it creates a crater. But actually, when you have a asteroid that's going that fast, 40,000 miles per hour, as you say, there's actually quite a bit of energy that is impacted on that object, and that actually can just sort of explode. Kind of think about like water. You can dive into a pool of water just fine, but if you do a belly flop, all that energy is distributed across your whole body, and you can actually have a pretty painful event if you were to just fall to the wall that way. Same exact thing with the asteroid. As it comes flying through the atmosphere, the asteroid actually provides a lot of resistance. It actually heats up that rock, and as it comes closer and closer to the Earth, more and more friction occurs, and the rock actually just explodes. The crater that we see off the Yucatan Peninsula is actually a result of an explosion that happened in the lower atmosphere, as opposed to the rock actually hitting the Earth. So, in terms of local effects, clearly anything that was in the vicinity was having a pretty bad day. The explosion would have vaporized everything in the local vicinity. It also would have, since the asteroid happened to hit right along the edge of some of the shoreline, the crater today off the Yucatan Peninsula is partially on land, kind of partially in the water. It's right along the coastline. That would have obviously created a large tsunami that would have ripped up chunks of the seafloor and thrown those chunks of the seafloor onto shorelines that are pretty far away from the actual impact sites. In addition to that, the asteroid would have picked up an immense amount of dust. So on a global scale, a common question a lot of geologists have is, how could this impact organisms globally? Obviously, locally, an organism could be vaporized or buried by a tsunami, but globally, the dust that gets thrown up into the atmosphere would have caused a perpetual kind of night situation, sort of nuclear winter-like, for at least a number of years. There was one study that actually found that the dust that got thrown up into the atmosphere could have stayed in the atmosphere for up to a year, maybe trace elements of it up to 5 years. So any organisms that rely on sunlight to photosynthesize, for example, would have not had access to that sunlight and would have had a lot of plant matter that would have died off. And that clearly would impact the organisms that eat the plants, and then it impacts the organisms that eat those organisms, and the whole food chain can kind of break down. But locally, you can imagine that some organisms would have vaporized, but the majority of organisms that actually went extinct because of this event would have been something more like the global sort of perpetual night that would have spanned across the entire planet. And that probably would have caused the extinction of a lot of organisms throughout the planet.
Yeah, and wasn't there a lot of wasn't there a lot of sulfur too in this area that would have been a result from things like acid rain or would have caused like acid rain?
Yeah, absolutely. As I said before, the The spot where the asteroid hit just happened to hit in an area that was really rich in sulfates. And that sulfur would have then been thrown to the atmosphere. And as we know from more modern examples, like industrial pollution can put sulfur into the atmosphere and cause acid rain. Same kind of thing might have happened here, that all that sulfur that was thrown up into the atmosphere just because of where the asteroid hits would have had a really devastating impact as well.
In addition to that, there was a lot of geologic evidence from this event. Melted rocks were found within the impact crater and shocked quartz. A shocked quartz, one of the more intriguing finds, were created from the high pressure shock associated with the impact. Can you explain what would have happened for these rocks to be created, and are these common with most impacts?
Yeah, so a couple things in there that we do see that gives us pretty clear evidence that an asteroid hit. One is the melted rock that you mentioned. As that explosion from that asteroid occurred, the heat that it generated would have been immense. It actually would have been so great that the rocks directly underneath the explosion would have essentially liquefied. And those liquid rocks from the force of the explosion actually can get tossed up into the atmosphere. Which is pretty crazy to think about, that literally liquid rock, for one, that rock can be liquefied, but if you get a high enough temperature, that can definitely happen. And then it can actually be thrown into the atmosphere. And then what goes up must eventually come down. Those liquid rocks would have cooled into tiny little rock pellets and fallen back down to the earth. So we actually see evidence of this. We actually find these little tiny, called impact spherulites, these tiny little balls of melted rock. That would have been essentially like hail, except hail being ice. This would have been falling rock that landed on the ground. And we actually see that in the rock record. And the only way you can make something like that is if you have these really extreme events like an asteroid impact. The other thing that you mentioned, shock quartz, is something that, again, also happens in either an asteroid impact or thermonuclear weapons being detonated. And as far as we're aware, dinosaurs didn't have thermonuclear weapons. So it seems that the shock quartz that we find is also due to the asteroid. How shock quartz actually happens is, well, first off, quartz is a mineral. Quartz is the most common mineral actually on our planet. If you go to the beach, little grains of sand are actually just little tiny grains of quartz. And if you've ever picked up sand and kind of rubbed it between your hands, that's extremely hard. Quartz is a really, really hard mineral. We actually use it and we can melt down that quartz and we make glass. Glass is also pretty hard substance as well. So it takes a lot to disturb quartz. It takes a lot to kind of mess up that structure. And if you look at quartz on a really, really fine scale, essentially it's a whole bunch of silica atoms bonded together. And those bonds are really, really strong. They don't get disturbed very easily, that's what makes the quartz overall very strong. However, if you subject it to an immense amount of pressure, you actually can disturb those bonds. Normally, all these bonds are in a nice, kind of rigid, sort of square pattern, but if you subject them to an immense amount of pressure, you can actually shift those bonds and it makes this irregular kind of pattern. And if you look under a microscope, shock quartz basically looks like these kind of linear scratch marks almost on an individual grain of quartz. And again, that can only happen if you have an immense amount of pressure. So the fact that we find both these impact spherulites and shock quartz tell us just how extreme the temperature and pressure changes because of this asteroid impact were during these times. And clearly it would have been enough to cause a mass extinction for any organisms that were in the area as well.
And that ties into my next question. So 75% of plant and animal species went extinct because of this event. And did this happen almost immediately, or was this more of a gradual event?
Well, that question is one that's bound to start a fight in many paleontological communities. So initially, right when Walter and Luis Alvarez made their discovery and announced that they had some good evidence that an asteroid impact caused the extinction, a lot of people immediately jumped to the immediate impact side of the discussion. That clearly asteroids are very instantaneous events, like one day they're there, one day they're not there, the next day they are. And a lot of people made a pretty good reason guess that dinosaurs would have died almost instantaneously, at least geologically instantaneously. Maybe it took a few years, but in the geologic record, that's pretty instantaneous. However, there are other events that could have caused the extinction that scientists aren't quite sure how they could have played into the mix as well. For example, we know that there was a number of volcanoes that were erupting around that time. In India, for example, there was this region known as the Deccan Traps, which released a lot of carbon dioxide and just mass scale volcanism. And we know from geologic record that volcanoes can cause extinctions as well. But gradually, as people started to find more and more evidence about these volcanoes, the pendulum actually shifted away from sort of immediate extinction to perhaps it's more gradual. Perhaps these volcanoes had a much bigger impact than we thought before. However, science seems to go where the evidence points. And as I would say in the last few years, more papers have come out that have actually shifted the pendulum back the other direction once again, to thinking that the impact was the main cause of extinction and the mass extinction happened nearly immediately. So scientists are still trying to work out exactly which of these two had a bigger impact. At this exact moment, it seems like the majority of scientists would agree that the asteroid impact had the biggest effect on these organisms, and that the extinction would have been pretty much immediately. However, there is a strong minority that suggests the other side of things, that it was more gradual. So more evidence, I'm sure, is going to come out in the future that might shift this one way or the other. But at least at the moment, it seems that the extinction would have been pretty immediate.
Now, with that, did the with species, which ones were more likely to survive the event, and what were the causes of this?
So we know that clearly not all organisms died in this event. There's still life on Earth. So some organisms did better during the extinction than others. In general, when we look at lots of different extinctions, not just this one, there's been at least five massive extinctions in the past. And the KPG is just the most recent example. And generally, when we look at extinctions, and the KPG is no exception to this, we notice that organisms that are smaller and have more generalist diets tend to be more likely to survive. The smaller, if you're a smaller organism, it's easier to survive on less resources. So if the food chain were to get disturbed and you're a small organism, well, it doesn't take a whole lot to keep you running. So you don't have to worry about massive disturbances in the food chain. Generalist diet just basically means an organism that can eat a lot of different things. So specialists will be the opposite of a generalist. Specialist is an organism that only survives on eating one particular type of plant or one particular type of prey. Well, if you're an organism like that, it's fine when there's plenty of that organism that you eat is around. But if changes in the food web start to occur and your prey's gone, obviously that means you're gonna die off as well. An organism that can eat lots of different things is much more likely to survive in the long run. So organisms that fit into those categories, smaller, more generalist lifestyles, are the ones that we tend to survive these massive extinction events.
Yeah, I think the ones that were more commonly talked about were things like smaller rodents, who had, in some terms, a rapid evolution because they didn't have, anything to really attack them or anything like that. But I think, can you elaborate more on that too?
Yeah, rodents are kind of a classic example of a survivalist species. They're definitely small. They eat a lot of different things, and you mentioned that they have rapid evolution. Like, it doesn't take very long for like a rodent to reach the point where it can start to reproduce. And evolution really functions heavily on successive generations. If you have an organism that can grow up to adulthood and give birth, that's basically a shorter amount of time in which a mutation could, take over and potentially give an advantage to an organism. So a rodent having those really fast generation time means it's going to have a much faster or a much better chance of randomly getting a mutation that could be advantageous. So rodents definitely fit the bill for potential organisms that could survive an event like this.
And it isn't just rodents either. It's avian species, and we still classify them as dinosaurs. So can you elaborate on the changes of that as well?
Yeah, so it's always interesting. We tend to talk about, even as paleontologists, we tend to talk about how the dinosaurs are all extinct and there are no more dinosaurs. But as you mentioned, taxonomically speaking, the way we classify birds and dinosaurs, birds are actually part of the same taxonomic group as dinosaurs. And a lot of dinosaurs, even back in the Cretaceous, have a lot of characteristics that are similar to modern-day birds. A lot of them have feathers, for example, which is a characteristic that we almost exclusively associate with birds. A lot of them, dinosaurs had hollow bones, which again is a characteristic of birds today. So, given that birds are dinosaurs, technically dinosaurs are doing better than they've ever done before. There's like 10,000 species of birds today. So we have a lot of dinosaurs around. They come in the form of pigeons and chickens and stuff like that, which is maybe not as exciting for the fifth graders out there who want to see a Tyrannosaurus Rex. But the types of dinosaurs that were more similar to the birds we see today also fit a lot of those characteristics I mentioned before. So they were smaller. So the smaller versions of dinosaurs tend to be the ones that survived and hence led to those smaller bird species we see today. And they probably had a more generalist diet, like I mentioned before, which allowed them to survive changes in the food web that might have been occurring at that time.
Awesome. That was my last question for today. So, David, I want to thank you for joining us again. Pleasure to have you, and you're welcome on our podcast anytime. And for our listeners out there, thank you for listening and stay curious. Thank you.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.